Of Job this morning. So if you want to be opening there to Job chapter 1, that will be where we begin. Before we begin this morning, let's bow in prayer. Our Father in heaven, we are so thankful for the occasion that we can gather here this morning and to study from your word, to learn the great lessons that you have provided to us in these Old Testament accounts. We're especially mindful as we go into our study this morning into the account of Job, your servant, and the example that he is before us. Help us to see the lessons that we might learn, to understand how that we might strive to follow in this way. Father, we pray that we'll do all things this morning, this day, in a way that will give you glory and honor. Amen. Okay. So we have established in our previous class last week some of the basic facts about Job and the time in which he lived. We talked about the fact that he would this would likely have been in the days of the patriarchs. And so here we've been going rather chronologically through the history from Genesis all the way through through the Kings and the Chronicles. So we've gone United Kingdom, Divided Kingdom, Judah alone, the captivity, and then the return from captivity, and we get all the way to the silent years. And so we've gone through this, really, the Old Testament history altogether. But now the next book after Esther is Job. But now where are we putting ourselves? Well, we're going to go back. Okay, we're going to go back and look at this account of Job and all that happens to him. But this is placed amongst, we mentioned how this is placed amongst the wisdom literature, along with Proverbs and Psalms and Proverbs and Ecclesiastes and Song of Solomon. And so we've discussed those things to help us get, you know, a place setting for when these things happened. And why is this? Why do we place this in the wisdom literature? What is there about this book that we mentioned that we would place this in the wisdom literature?
It reveals a lot about the mind of God, how he deals with those who obey him.
Mm-hmm. And the bulk of the book, poetry, right? Great deal of Hebrew poetry. And so the writing style and the way that the conversation is developed, there's a great deal of that follows much of the wisdom literature. And so we can see that's natural placement as we kind of group things in our minds to help us sort of organize these things for our learning. Okay. So those were some of the background things that we went through. Now, we look here at the beginning of Job, and it opens with a narrative. And this part's easy. The narrative's easy. It's a very good telling of the accounts that happened here. And it opens with there was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, And that man was blameless and upright, and one who feared God and shunned evil. So we open with this first description of Job. Blameless and upright, feared God and shunned evil. I'm embarrassed to stop right here, but I've already forgotten. I mean, it takes me about 30 seconds to forget something, maybe less. Does anyone, we passed out some questions from the beginning of Job last week. Does anyone need those questions? And I do want to pause at this point and get those out. So will you raise your hand if you don't have any? We do have some around. So let's go ahead. There will be three sheets that you will get with this. Okay? So we'll go ahead and get those passed out. I'm sorry for the interruption there, but I do want to get those out at this moment. Should have done that before the opening comments. Okay, so as that's being done, let's think about some of these descriptors and how Job is described and his character. So, blameless and upright. So, when we think about the term blameless, and some versions will say and use the word perfect, and we go, well, nobody's perfect. No one's perfect. What does this mean when we say blameless or perfect? What's meant by that? In God's eyes, is what you say? Okay, so Sue says that no one can bring a charge against you that has any substance. Nothing that could be backed up. Blameless in that regard, right? What's another word that's used when we use the word perfect? Complete. Okay, very good. So we use the term complete to in place. And so this is where, I think this is where this term integrity comes into play. And you think about what integrity means. You know, to use the same phrase, all the parts are integrated. Everything is integrated together. Everything is connected. Everything is complete. There's nothing lacking. There's nothing missing. And that would be the idea of having integrity, of being complete, of being perfect, to be blameless. Almost as if Job was doing all that he could to follow God. And he didn't leave God out in any part of his life. It was all encompassing and it was whole. And that's the idea, I think, that we should draw from this term and this description of him being blameless. No hypocrisy. There's nothing, he's one way in this sense and he's another way in another sense. There's nothing contradicting, would be another thing to think about. All right, so what about this? It just reminds me of other characters that we know. And think about Noah. And what is said of Noah in Genesis chapter 6 and verse 9? You remember how that's put? Anyone? What's said of Noah? He found grace in the eyes of God in verse 8. And how is he described in verse 9? What's said in verse 9? Righteous and blameless in his generation. The New King James uses the term perfect. Perfect in his generations. It's the same concept, isn't it? Okay? And then, just hold your place there, but I'm flipping over to Hebrews chapter 11, and it says of Noah, well, it says of Noah in the conclusion, as it summarizes Noah and that he walked with God, perfect in his generation, and that he became the heir of righteousness, which is according to faith. So Noah was righteous. Noah walked with God. Noah, blameless, complete, perfect in his generations. Similar description. And then you think about, in Genesis 5, you think about Enoch, right? Walked with God. Enoch was Noah's great-grandfather. Walked with God, and God took him. And Hebrews 11 and verse 5 says, as Enoch was taken away, he did not see death. God had taken him. For before he was taken, he had this testimony that he pleased God. So we have Enoch, one that walked with God, one that had this same kind of integrity, this same kind of character that is given to Job. And that's what God's asking of his people. And he's asked that of his people from the beginning of time. To follow me. To live for me. To be righteous. Walk in my ways. Genesis chapter 17, God told Abraham to walk before him and to be, what's the word? Blameless. He told Abraham, walk before me and be blameless. In Deuteronomy chapter 18, as Moses is giving the law and they're about to go again, and they're about to go into the land, and in that passage where he's saying, as you go into this land, do not adopt the things that these people have done. I haven't given you those kinds of ways. Do not take those things on. Do not follow in their wickedness. And it says in verse 13, you shall be blameless before the Lord your God. So those are some passages that use some of the same phrasing. And I think it was just worthy of pausing and thinking about how that Job was doing what God expects of all of us, to live in that way before him. Turn to Psalm 1. I think this also is related and helps us kind of get an idea of this type of character that we're looking for. Psalm 1. Blessed is the man who walks not, in the negative sense here, who walks not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor stands in the path of sinners, nor sits in the seat of the scornful. His delight is in the law of the Lord, and in his law he meditates day and night. And so it makes that contrast. Blessed is the man who doesn't do these things. He doesn't walk in evil ways and follow those paths. He chooses a different way. He chooses God's way. He shuns evil and walks in the paths of the Lord. And how does it conclude in verse 6 of Psalm 1. For the Lord knows the way of the righteous. He knows the way of the righteous. God's aware when people follow in His paths. He knows them. The Lord knew the way of Job. In verse 8, God's going to describe Job in exactly the same way as He's introduced, that he's blameless and upright, one who fears God and shuns evil, turns away from evil, choosing not to walk in wicked ways. A passage that we could relate, Proverbs 16 and verse 6, and what we like about this is that it puts it just exactly how it is here. By the fear of the Lord, one departs from evil. By the fear of the Lord, one would shun evil. And that's just exactly what Job was doing. So what a great character, right? What a great example for us to follow. And I think there's some... it's a great study, a great character study, to see the character of Job. Okay, comments, thoughts before we continue on.
I think it's just so refreshing to see Job as a man who had a heart, not divided, where there's no separation here. His purpose is to serve God with all righteousness.
Yes. All of his thoughts are on God. Everything he does is motivated by what God would choose. In Proverbs 16, it speaks toward the same thing that you're talking about. When a person is guided by the ways of the Lord. Like in verse 1, the preparations of the heart belong to man, but the answer of the tongue is from the Lord. I mean, your speech is going to be what God would speak. Your ways are going to be what God's ways would be. Verse 3, commit your works to the Lord and the thoughts. Your thoughts will be established. How are your thoughts established? Because I choose to walk in His ways. You know, when we make that decision, we're going to walk in that path, then our actions are all guided. Our actions are all determined because of those principles that we have and what we decide that's going to lead our way. And I like that too. I think it's a very refreshing to see this and that God is looking for this and we can do it. We can live in this way. And so the encouragement here, the admonishment is, fight for that way. Let's really be diligent about living in this way because it can be done. Are we talking about sinlessness? Are we talking about being sinless in the standpoint that I've never done wrong and never will do wrong? No, we're not, are we? Because then you might be able to boast in that. You might be able to say that you're justified by your works and the things that you've done, and that you would then deserve a reward of heaven because you were sinless and perfect. Oh, we're not talking about that. But we're talking about a mindset such that when you commit yourself to that way, that you live by that way with all of your intent and purpose, and that you have no evil in your heart. That's what we're talking about. Okay. So, as the narrative continues, it discusses all of his possessions, all of his livestock, all of the wealth that he has. And in verse 3 at the end of it, so that this man was the greatest of all the people of the East. That is how blessed he was. His sons would go and feast in their houses, each on his appointed day, and they would send, gather their sisters, and they would have their feasts. And so were these feasts annual, perhaps? We don't know. It doesn't say anything about how often these feasts would happen, whatever the frequency was. Potentially they were a 7-day feast with 7 sons, right? And maybe it was a 7-day feast. Hard to say. However, at the end of these days, at the end of this of these times, what would Job do at the end of this? What was it that he did? He would offer sacrifices. And so he would sanctify them and consecrate them, offer sacrifices for each one of them. Perhaps that they might have cursed God. Maybe they've done something wrong. And I mean, that was his way. Always thinking about what was the good and looking out not just for his own actions, but interested in the souls of his children, and that they also would be righteous before God. And so he was very concerned for them as well. So we see that Job has a love for what is good, a love for what is right, and for his desire, and his desire for his children to also the desire for his children to also walk in his ways. So, in verse 5, at the end of it, it says, "Thus Job did regularly." This is just his way. Also, adding to his character. All right. So, what happens? There's a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also comes among them. And so God is saying, where do you come from? Satan says, from going to and fro on earth and from walking back and forth on it. And God says to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? That there's none like him on all the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears the Lord, who fears God and shuns evil. So God asks Satan, have you considered him? In the side note, in the New King James Version, it says, have you set your heart on him? And don't you know that Satan had set his heart on Job? That he saw Job and wanted with all of his might to see him fall. And so God says, have you set your heart on him? Have you considered my servant Job? None like him in all the earth. What a thing it is to have God say that of you. And so Satan answers, does Job fear God for nothing? So essentially, Satan says, Job only fears you because he gains physically from doing so. His work is blessed. His possessions are increased. And this is why he follows you. Because it's a reward to him. He gets gain from this. Take it all away, and he'll curse you to your face. That's the only reason he's following you. But what does God know about Job? God knows Job's ways. God knows Job's heart. That's why he can say to Satan, "Have you considered him? There's none like him in all the earth." God knows how Job would respond to this challenge. So God replies, "Everything he has is now in your hands. It's now in your power. Only what? Only what? Don't hurt him. Everything he has is in your power. Just don't hurt him." So, in one day, it happens that his oxen and his donkeys are stolen, his servants are killed. One person comes and says, "I alone have escaped to share this with you." And it says, while he was still speaking, another comes. And fire from heaven burned up the sheep and the servants that were taking care of them that burned up too. "I alone have escaped to share this." And while he's still speaking, another. The camels are stolen. All the servants who took care of them have been killed. And I alone have escaped. And yet, while he's still speaking, a fourth comes and says, "A great wind from the wilderness comes and collapses the house that all of your children were in, and they have all died." All at once, all in the same conversation, in the same moment. Job's world is crashing around him. He's losing everything all at once. And how does he respond? You mean you try to put yourself in his shoes and you think, "Well, what would I do? What would I do?" How does Job respond to this? He worships, doesn't he? There's mourning. I mean, there's tearing of his robe. He shaves his head, all indicators of mourning. And he falls to the ground and he worships the Lord. If you think about losing all that you have, and the most dreadful, all of your children all at once, would you think to stop and worship God in that moment? A very impressive thing about Job's character and his mind and how firmly rooted he was in God's ways. And so, what does he say? He says, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. All things come from him. He gave me all of this. If he gave it to me, I didn't deserve it. He can surely take it all away." And one of the greatest things in all of this, Job did not sin, nor did he charge God with wrong. And have we ever heard anyone, when bad things happen to them, have we ever heard anyone blame God? Have we ever blamed God? Okay. That's pretty powerful. And so you think, nothing could be worse. And we get into chapter 2. And so now in chapter 2, the sons of God came to present themselves to before the Lord, and Satan came also among them to present himself before the Lord. And the Lord said to Satan, from where do you come? I'm going to and fro on the earth. It's the same conversation. But what's different? Just a little bit different. Have you considered my servant Job? There's none like him on all the earth. That he is blameless. He's an upright man. He shuns evil. He fears the Lord, shuns evil. But God adds this, and he still holds fast to his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without cause. Now think of that. And how does Satan answer? Skin for skin. All that a man has, he will give up for his life. Stretch out your hand now, just like he did before. Stretch out your hand now. But this time he says, touch his bone and his flesh. Do harm to him. Take away his health. Take away how he feels physically. Take away all of that, and he will surely curse you to your face. And so Satan challenges God in that. And so God said, behold, he's in your hand. But what? Spare his life. Don't take his life. And so, Satan goes, strikes Job with painful boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And we find Job sitting in ashes, scraping his sores with a shard of clay. And then what happens? Yeah. Now, another loss. Now his wife challenges him. Do you still hold fast to your integrity? Curse God and die. And she's saying something like this. Give it up. See where believing God, see where following God has gotten you. Nowhere. This has done nothing for you. Look at where you are. It's all for naught. Give it up. Curse God and die. And you think about her position. All that Job lost, she lost. She lost her children. And again, I think, how would I respond? And so how does Job respond to her? Shall we indeed accept good from God? And shall we not accept adversity? Do we think that the only things that we can get are good things? Do you think that we can just, well, we just, the bad things, I don't need to have any of those things. I only want good things. Well, if we accept the good, then we need to accept the bad too. Whatever it is, it doesn't matter. That's not what my faith is based on. Is do I get good things out of this? And that's exactly what God knew about Job. That his faith and his following him was not based on those things, as Satan had accused him. And in what else is said, in all of this, Job did not sin with his lips. Now, at this point, we see how far Job's life has come crashing around him. He really, essentially, has lost everything. And now he has his friends come. His three friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. And they knew Job. And they knew him well. And they had discussed and decided, let us go and visit with Job. Let us mourn with him. They hear of his great losses. Let's mourn with him and try to comfort him. And you hear about how badly one suffers. But when they gather and they go to visit Job and they see him, Job was so disfigured that they didn't even recognize him at first. And when they realize what Job has gone through, they see with their eyes his condition, and they wept. They tore their robes, sprinkled dust on their heads toward heaven, and they sat down on the ground with him as he was sitting in the ashes. And for 7 days, 7 days, they didn't say a word to him. They sat in silence. And don't you know that there are those times where, what am I going to say? There's nothing to say. Just the greatness of the calamity that I can't even use words to capture this. I don't even know how to begin. And so they sit in silence. And sometimes that's just the right thing to do. So it's pretty bleak, these first two chapters. But in the middle of it, we can see some very great things about the person's faith and what it ought to be and what faith really is and how it's based on things completely outside of the things that are physical blessings. Okay. So now we come to chapter 3. And so now we see this chart here. And Jensen's chart here, the first couple chapters, Job's tested, the challenges of Satan as we've discussed. And chapter 3, the descriptions are Job despairs and the complaint of Job. That's chapter 3. So finally someone breaks the silence. The 7-day silence, finally it's broken. And it's Job. Job opens his mouth and speaks. And what does he do? What does he say? Job curses the day of his birth. And this is where the poetic language really comes in. Because you could simply say, cursed be the day that I was born. But Job says, and puts it in these ways, may the day perish on which I was born. May the day be darkness. The day that I was born, let it be darkness. Don't let the light shine on that day. Let darkness and the shadow of death claim that day. Yeah, a cloud will settle on it. May the blackness of the day terrify that day that I was born. And then he personifies this and says, may that day not rejoice among all the days of the year. Let that day not rejoice. Let that day not be counted among all the days of the years of the year. Don't let it be even counted into the number of the months. Let that day be cursed. Let no joyful shout come from that. Anyone that curses, let him curse that day. May the stars of its morning, verse 9, be dark. Let that day, may it look for light, but have none. And let it not see the dawning of the day, because it did not shut up the doors of my mother's womb, nor hide sorrow from my eyes. Why is he cursing the day of his birth? Why does he go there? He's in pain. Yeah, that's right. If he had never been born, he wouldn't have to experience this. That would be the solution to all this is to have never been born. It's that severe. So he curses the day of his birth. And then he essentially asks two questions. How much time do I have left?
4 minutes.
Perfect. He asks two questions. The first, verse 11, why did I not die at birth? Why didn't I perish? And then he contrasts that with this. Verses 13 through 19, he begins to describe some things about death. And that death would be an answer, a solution. That death would be a relief to where he is right now. Verse 13, for now, if I had died that day, I would have lain still and been quiet. I would have been asleep. I would have been at rest with kings and counselors of the earth. Verse 16 is a similar question to his first. Why was I not hidden like a stillborn child, like infants who never saw the light? Because there the wicked cease from troubling, and the weary are at rest. There the prisoners rest together. They do not hear the voice of the oppressor. The small and great are there, and the servant is free from his master. Oh, that death. That would be a relief to me at this point. And so if you think of Job's perspective and what all has happened to him, you can start to see how he would go, death would be a welcome to me right now. It sounds awful, but it's very possible to get into that state, to get yourself in that position. Now, finally, the last question. Why is light given to him who is in misery and life to the bitter soul? Similar question in verse 23. Why is light given to a man whose way is hidden and whom God is hedged in? In this condition, why are you allowed to still live in conditions that are so horrible and so dark and so miserable? Why am I allowed to keep living? And finally, in verse 25, he says, "For the thing I greatly feared has come upon me, and what I dreaded has happened to me." What was that? What was it that he feared? It's interesting. "But the thing that I greatly feared has come upon me." I think Job, back in chapter 1, when he heard of all those things came crashing down and he lost everything, and he says, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, naked I shall return there. The Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." I think Job was saying, "Take me. I'm ready to go too. I've lost it all. I don't want to be here." And I think Job hoped to die. And I think what he dreaded was that he would live through this and have to experience this. And I think we see that here in verse 25. All right. Tough stuff. But I think the final thought is that God allows us sometimes to be in a place like this where we have nothing but Him to live on. Next week, chapter 4.